You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 5th, 2023. Well, any day now could be the new date that will live in infamy, as ominous hints at an attack against the Russian-held nuclear power plant at Zaporizhia are being floated in the world presses. Both the Kyiv government and its American sponsor have filtered information into the media mainstream, suggesting Russia will, as it did with the Nord Stream pipelines and Kakhovka Dam, sacrifice its own infrastructure in a false flag attempt to make Ukraine look bad. The conflict has already gone nuclear in a sense, with both documented missile and mortar attacks against Zaporizhia and the introduction of depleted uranium munitions. So it seems, after nearly 80 years of an uneasy atomic detente, the thing most feared by generations past has begun, if in an unexpected way. Dave Lindorf is an American publisher, Izzy award-winning investigative journalist, author, founder of the web news site ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, and documentary producer whose now released film, A Compassionate Spy, tells the tale of Ted Hall, wunderkind physicist and spy who may well have saved Russia and the world from nuclear conflagration. Lindorf's written a companion book for the film, too, called Spy for No Country. Dave Lindorf in the first half. And among those that know, right now is the most dangerous moment the world has ever known. More than Ronald Reagan's reign of error, where the pitch of Western belligerence against the Soviet Union pinned the needle, the current slide into the big muddy of nuclear Armageddon is beginning to seem a grotesque inevitability. But there was a precedent matching the horror of our moment. John Kennedy's retreat from the brink during the Cuban Missile Crisis is a fragile beacon of hope for our survival, and fittingly, it is being seized upon by JFK's nephew, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., in his bid for the Democratic Party nomination for president. Jim Kavanaugh is a former college professor, now publishing political and social analysis as The Polemicist on Substack and making videos on the same topics at Rumble. His articles appear online at, among other places, the Grenville Post and Counterpunch.org, where his recent article, RFK Jr.'s Chances, appears. Jim Kavanaugh and Is Another Kennedy Enough in the second half. But first, Dave Lindorf and the whistleblower who saved the world. Well, hey, welcome back to the show, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure. You know that. Well, Dave, we've talked a lot about this documentary over the last couple of years, and now it's finally out on the other side of the pond in England. It came out in March, and The Guardian's written a 5-star review.
That was really exciting because that was our first mass market review. We had a lot of great reviews in the trade press, you know, like Hollywood Reporter and Variety during the festival season that it was playing. But this was the first mass market one. It'll be interesting to see how the U.S. media responds to it.
This is a documentary film, just so the people aren't confused. But it's a major film in documentary terms. It's, you know, a big budget film with a big name documentary director.
Yeah, Steve James agreed to take this story on. He was really drawn to it when I told him all about it. And I was a producer on it, along with Mark Mitten. And I wouldn't call it a big budget film, but it got, for a documentary, it got decent funding from participant films, which offered to pay for whatever the costs were. You know, it didn't lack for funding.
Well, and Steve James is a twice Oscar nominated director, and people might remember Hoop Dreams. That was a big film, I guess, like late 80s or early 90s, if I remember properly.
Yeah, he's done some really great films. He had two. The other was Life Itself that got a Academy Award. And then he also did this wonderful film that I was lucky enough to be in as a reporter on camera, but not in a producer role or anything, called Abacus, Small Enough to Fail, about a Chinese bank that was the only bank indicted for mortgage fraud in the fiscal crisis.
Well, so now what's A Compassionate Spy about? Can you give me the elevator pitch?
It's about a teenage, brilliant teenage Harvard physics student, junior, who was hired by the Manhattan Project to work at Los Alamos, where he was assigned to the refining the implosion system of the plutonium bomb that was used in the Trinity test and Nagasaki bombing.
Yeah, and when you say junior, this is what always amazes me about Ted Hall, and I still, I just can't get my head around it, that he was like a teenager when he was in Harvard and a teenager when he was a participating scientist at the Los Alamos in the Manhattan Project, and not, he wasn't getting coffee and stuff. I mean, he got
his degree, which was awarded in absentia in spring of 44, based on the work he had done at Manhattan Project and the coursework that he'd completed at Harvard before going to Los Alamos. Still at 18, he was made team leader on a major part of the project of the plutonium bomb. So this was not a, as you say, you know, he wasn't getting coffee or, you know, doing, being handed calculations to work out or something by a senior scientist. He was a senior scientist by that point.
Well, and then at 19, he took this huge step. He decided that, well, he had to reveal to the Soviets the secrets that he had been working on the atomic bomb.
It was in the late summer of 1944, after he'd only been working at Los Alamos for, say, 8 months, he realized, as many senior scientists there did, that Germany was not going to win the war, that it was not going to get a atomic bomb before the U.S., and that or at all, and that, you know, there really was no reason to be building the bomb. And then he heard, you know, the scuttlebutt that of Groves speaking to a bunch of the British scientists there at a dinner saying, well, you realize that the real target of this bomb was not Germany and has always been the Soviet Union. So to Ted, this was just a nightmare because he realized very presciently, I think, that one country with the bomb, and especially the U.S. with its history at that time of incipient fascism, was a huge risk to humanity and specifically to the Soviet Union, which at that time was, you know, our major ally in World War II in Europe. And so he just decided the only thing, he saw that efforts were being made by, you know, people like Niels Bohr and Josef Rotblat to try to convince the president, first Roosevelt and later Truman, to not use the bomb and to share what was going on with the Soviet Union and try to use it to leverage ending the bomb and banning it after the war, that, you know, instead of that, they were hiding it from the Soviet Union. As far as he knew, there were no spies in the Manhattan Project, and that he needed to share it to prevent that monopoly on the part of the U.S. after the war.
But he made this leap at 19 years of age to spill to the Russians, to leak all this information to them. Was it because he didn't trust what an American monopoly would do with the bomb? I mean, it's pretty common knowledge now in the years that have transpired since the end of the Second World War. We've seen the atrocities, the serial atrocities of American hegemony around the world. Was it an idea on his part that America could become this or was already this that made him determined to even the playing field, so to speak, or what?
Yeah, he expressly argued this with, you know, talking with his friend and eventually spy courier, Savvy Sachs, that the concern was that he very strongly felt that the U.S. coming out of the war with a, you know, with an animosity towards the Soviet Union and with, you know, the absolute control of nuclear weapons from 1945 until probably a decade or more to used that weapon, and he was convinced that that was a strong likelihood that needed to be resisted. And the only way he could think of to do it was to have another country that could stand against that with nuclear weapons of its own. The country that would stand against the U.S. That potentially could have the bomb was the Soviet Union.
Was this before or after Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Oh, no, this was before.
This
calculus on his part that required him to, in his perception, to become a spy and give the plans to the Russians for the plutonium bomb was that was happening in the fall of 1944 and was realized in October and, 44 and on through the rest of the war.
So he was certain that the United States would use this weapon, this terrible weapon almost unthinkable.
He wasn't certain, but he said that the probability of it was high and that, it was too big a risk to allow the U.S. to come out of the war with a monopoly like that. And I totally agree with him. I think he nailed it.
You talk about risk now. I mean, he and Savvy Sachs, who I want you to tell me a little more about in a second, but they risked everything. I mean, this in the atmosphere of the times, they risked the firing squad for what they were doing.
He was in the military at the time. He'd been drafted the spring of 1944, so he was in uniform.
Well, who was Savvy Sachs now with such an unusual name and to take such an unusual risk as to throw in with his pal in this deception and this treachery, treason?
Yes, his name is Savvy Sachs. And like Ted, he was a child of Russian immigrant Jews. Actually, he was more of a communist than Ted ever was in the sense that, first of all, his mother was a ardent supporter of Stalin and a member of the U.S. Communist Party. She had been a communist in Ukraine before they came to the U.S. even. And so he was raised in that kind of environment and was I would say he was a committed communist, and he was a liberal arts major at Harvard and befriended Ted. I think the way they met each other really was in this sort of remnant of the 30s. Harvard had a John Reed Club named after in honor of, John Reed, the journalist and Harvard alumnus who wrote 10 Days That Shook the World and, who was one of those pioneers of participant journalism.
Made famous in the Warren Beatty film Reds.
Yeah, exactly. So they met there. And at that point, it was no longer, it had been dropped in 1936, I think, by the Communist Party as a front organization, along with its other chapters around the country, mostly at universities and so on. And in Harvard, it lingered on because of the name of John Reed and his association with Harvard. So there were like 12 or 14 guys who were in it, and it was basically a place to fool around, crack jokes and debate Marxist minutia, and it even had two chapters because there were factions.
Splitters.
It was a fun thing to do and not a serious communist organization, but they met there and became close friends and eventually roommates the second year. In 43, they were just going to the meetings and they knew each other. And in 44, Sachs joined Ted and Roy Glauber, another 18-year-old physics whiz who went with Ted to Los Alamos.
What happened to Savvy Sachs, though? He didn't have that kind of protection, did he?
Well, they had the protection that was afforded by Ed, and I'll explain that because that was my big break. I discovered with a FOIA investigation of Ed with the FBI and getting his file. But Ed was the inventor of the Minuteman missile and was the head of the Air Force's ICBM development program from 1957 on, and was in charge of the, before that, of the engine motor program through the early 50s for ICBMs and other long-range rockets to carry nuclear weapons. Ed was a Caltech and trained engineer, super brilliant, and had been 11 years older than Ted. He had been the one who took over Ted's education at the age of four, telling his parents that he was brilliant and he needed special, you know, care and feeding, kind of mentally.
Right, and Saville Sachs, though, he did Ed,
here, well,
Ed's protection.
Here's the thing, the FBI file shows that in 1950, as soon as Hoover was alerted in April to the translation of a Venona document that actually identified Ted and Savvy as Soviet spies, he started a dragnet around the country to find them and investigate them, and then in 1951 in March, he pulled the trigger and picked them both up on the street in Chicago, brought them to the bureau where office in Chicago, where both of them were separately and unknowingly of each other grilled for several hours on what they knew about being spies, and both of them denied everything. But, not very believably. But at that point, Hoover, even before that, January 6th, before he had done that, he alerted General Joseph Carroll, who was the head of the intelligence operation for the Air Force, that Major Hall, the older brother of a known Los Alamos, of Ted Hall, who was a known Los Alamos Soviet spy, was someone that he should be concerned about and that he was investigating. And he asked permission to have his agents question Ed Hall. And what I learned from the file also was that Joseph Carroll told Hoover, who he used to be an aide to, and who really admired Hoover, he told Hoover that he was going to handle the investigation through the Air Force, and they did, and he didn't give him urgent access to Ed. The FBI didn't get to investigate Ed until or question Ed until June 12th, That's months after he asked for permission to do it. And at that point, he also had to have OSI officers monitoring it to be sure that all he asked about was what Ed knew about Ted, not about Ed himself. About 3 weeks after that interview, the Air Force promoted Ed to lieutenant colonel and put him in charge of the engine development program for ICBMs in their secret laboratory. So they just believed Ed was a loyal American engineer and member of the Air Force. And Hoover had to shut it down because, remember, this was the rise of McCarthy. McCarthy was saying that the military was infested with communists. And if Ted had been arrested, or Savvy Sachs was arrested, only Savvy Sachs, it would very quickly have made Ed Hall radioactive, and they would have lost their top missile guy, who, the U.S. was behind in large missile development from the Russians, so they couldn't afford to lose Ed. So therefore, I see in the files for Ted and Savvy that at the beginning of 1952, they dropped both of them from their special security index, which meant they were no longer going to be monitored on a daily basis.
Well, whatever damage that they could do, they'd already done anyway. I would say, other than, you know, wanting to punish them or use them as some kind of example. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave's an American journalist, a publisher, an Izzy Award-winning journalist, I should say. He's an author. He's founder of the news website thiscan'tbehappening.net. We're talking about his now released overseas but coming in August documentary film about Ted Hall, the American wunderkind scientist and spy, a compassionate spy. You've written a companion book that's coming out around the same time as the film's going to be released. Is that the idea? Spy for No Country?
So far, it's looking like it's going to come out in November with Prometheus Press, which is a great name for a press book. It will be much more detailed and cover the stuff about the role Ed played in keeping Ted from ever getting prosecuted, and from the story coming out until 1995 or six when the Venona transcripts were released publicly. So, and I go into much more detail about the whole story. With it's a 100,000 word book, well footnoted, and I'm going through the galley pages right now to make sure catch the last little errors. But that'll come out about the time that the movie's going to come out on Hulu.
It makes me wonder. I mean, I, as I said, I'm just so amazed that these guys were so young. And I guess being young, you can afford to be reckless, or at least you're not preternaturally reckless. Or at least relatively so. But it makes me wonder if that kind of courage is something only found in the past. Daniel Ellsberg passed away last month, and he was famous for the Pentagon Papers released during the Vietnam era. And then he did a lot of stuff after that as well, one of those being the founding the Freedom of the Press Foundation. When I was reading the Foundation's About Us page today, and it sounds a lot like what WikiLeaks was doing, and it brought to mind, to me at least, the fate of Julian Assange, that other publisher and journalist who is languishing yet in Belmarsh Prison in London, but could be extradited any day to America, as all of the legal hurdles keeping that from happening in Britain have leaped. So to speak. Is it? I'm fumbling towards Dave a question here about the environment that we're in right now. And I hesitate to say it's as severe as McCarthyism, but in a lot of ways it's more so. What do you think about where we're at right now, and especially in the U.S.?
You know, most of the people that were attacked by McCarthy, or really more of the attacks that had impact, were in HUAC. But the biggest thing that people lost were their careers. Many, many academics and film people, newspaper people lost their jobs because of being accused of being communists, or because they refused to name names, when they were put before these committees in Congress. Some went to jail, but that was when they went to jail, it was for refusing to name names and that kind of thing. Whereas now, people are being tried, like Assange is threatened with being tried, and other people have gone to jail for violating the Espionage Act of 1917. So that's a hoary vehicle to go after people with. It's in some ways a more dangerous time, like you say. In others, we have certain freedoms. But, the freedoms have been grossly eroded because of this Supreme Court. You can't count on I was thinking about how the first spy identified in the Venona was Judith Kaplan. And she was tried and convicted of spying for the Soviets in 1949. She ended up being released because a judge was outraged that her phone was tapped without a wiretap approval by a court. That's laughable today. I mean, you know, national security matters. The courts just routinely excuse the violations of the FBI and the NSA and stuff, and people get convicted anyway.
Yeah, well, or any border guard can grab your communication devices and go perusing through your whole history. So much for the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Yeah. So it is a very fraught time. And you know, also, I think journalists were protected, for instance. I mean, Ellsberg also would have been tried, but his case never went to court because the judge threw it out because of the raid by the plumbers on his psychiatrist's file cabinet and looking at Ellsberg's file. I mean, that would not happen today with the current high court.
Well, and it's been proven, too, it's documented that the bugging of the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy where Assange was held where took refuge for so many years, was bugged, and the American government was listening in on all of his conversations with his lawyers.
And plotting ways to assassinate him with a fake breakout. You know, those things should have thrown this case out immediately, and they haven't.
Well, Dave, we're fast running out of time. Where this is what we talk about is how Ted Hall saved the world from, well, certainly Russia and perhaps the whole world from the nuclear immolation. Now here we are in 2023, standing on the brink, as I said in the introduction, of a period more dangerous perhaps than any other time, and just this week. There's balloons going up from the White House and from Kyiv saying, oh, there's going to be an explosion at the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia that are pretty hard to swallow. And it seems like, and that the Kyiv has already attacked it with missiles and mortars repeatedly. what do you think about now? What would Ted Hall do were he still alive?
Well, I write about this at the end of the book that, you know, everybody's worried that there could be a nuclear war over Ukraine. And I keep saying, as scary as it looks, I'm pretty confident that will not happen. And for the same reason that nuclear war hasn't happened since 1945, when we bombed two Japanese cities, and that is that now a nuclear war is suicide. Any nuclear war will eventually escalate to a conflict between two great nuclear powers with the bombs that either one could destroy the entire world. And so I think that, you know, one way or another, it will be avoided. I think I'm right. I hope I'm right. But to the extent that I'm right, I would say that Ted Hall and Klaus Fuchs, the other spy that gave the Russians the real keys to the bomb, are the reason that it won't happen.
Well, and I only hope that there's more people like Ted Hall and like Fuchs and like Ellsberg and like Assange that will risk it all, and Edward Snowden will risk it all to come forward and do the right thing.
You and me both. Ellsberg said that expressly in one of his last statements.
Well, Dave, sadly, we have to break it off here. Good luck with the film opening. We'll talk again perhaps in August when it's out and it's being raved. And of course, there's a big Hollywood picture, Oppenheimer, is being released around the same time as well, a biopic on the famous head of the Manhattan Project.
And
a whole other thing.
Ted has a cameo appearance in that film. I'm looking forward to seeing what, in fact, that is.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting, too. Hey, well, I'm going to break off then, and Jim Cavanaugh is going to come up in the second half, and we're going to talk a little bit about RFK, another Kennedy, and when one Kennedy saved us during the missile crisis in Cuba, maybe the next Kennedy, well, we'll see about what his chances are. And I'll play out with Dave with the trailer from the movie that's online right now. And again, it's A Compassionate Spy. Thanks a lot, Dave, for coming on and talking to me again, eh?
Thanks for having me, Chris. Bye-bye.
He was working on the implosion bomb. It was one of the major secrets of the war.
have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction.
Something gruesome and horrible was being constructed.
Knowledge should be shared. They had decided they wanted to get in touch with the Soviets. Ted had passed along the